Ezekiel.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Ezekiel 30. We're working our way through Ezekiel 38, and we've been gone for a couple of weeks, I guess, or so. So we've worked our way up to where we were looking at the last part of Ezekiel 38. And that I thought might be good just to remember some of the setting again. So Ezekiel 38 and 39 are kind of sandwiched between 37 and 40.
Math lesson 101.
That's an engineer's perception here.
So the thing about that is that, so it's like when you read the Gospels, when you first start reading the Bible, you just read it. And you just kind of read it like a book, and you read it, and you just go through it. And then over time, you start paying more attention to the structure. So you instead, it's kind of like if you're hiking, right? You first hiking, you just go through the woods, and you see the trees. But you don't look at a topo map necessarily, or you don't stop and think about how does the river that you see, where does it start, where does it flow through, you know. So as you get more familiar with the terrain,
mm-hmm.
or things you're seeing, you step back more and more, and you start looking at more of an overview and seeing how this little parts of the park that you're in fit together in the bigger whole of the whole scheme of the geography. And well, that kind of happens too as you read the more you read the Bible, because when you first start, you're just trying to figure out what each sentence means. Right? Or who is this? What does he mean by that? Right? And so you have plenty to keep you busy just doing that. But over time, as you get more familiar with the Bible, you'll start to notice that there's intention to how things are put together. And so sometimes in the Gospels, you'll notice that the order in which things are presented in the Gospels, they aren't always necessarily exactly strictly in chronology order. Sometimes they're rearranged in an order to make a certain point or lead in a certain direction. And in Ezekiel, what we saw was when we got past all the kind of the dirges against all the various enemies of Israel, we got to the place where in 36, you know, pretty much God was talking about, or through Ezekiel, was talking about the fact that he's going to bring Israel, he's going to regenerate Israel as a nation and bring them to a point where even though they've been disobedient, that they would know him and he would put his spirit within them. And then from 36 we got to 37, and we saw in 37 that the vision of the Valley of the Bones, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to make the point there that 37 is a restatement of much of what's in 36, but it's giving more specifics, and it's put to this vision of these bones that their hope is lost, they're cut off, there's nothing more for them. And then he talks about this idea that he's going to reassemble these bones, then he's going to, you know, put flesh on them, he's going to blow his spirit into them and basically revive Israel. He says these bones are the whole house of Israel. And part of this business of reassembling the bones and bringing these cadavers, if you will, back to life, after that is that they're planted in their land, which is also what we saw in 36. So there's this theme in 36 and 37 about God's going to bring Israel out of her period of disobedience in the latter days, at the time of the end kind of idea. And in the process, he's going to gather Israel back. He's going to bring them to recognize who he is, and ultimately he's going to pour out his spirit on Israel in a way where many of the Jews are going to turn to him. It says in Romans, all Israel will be saved. So when we get to 36 and 37, and then we get to at the end of 37 when he says he's going to regather them and bring them back, and he's going to put his spirit in them and he will be in their midst. It talks in there that he will dwell in their midst in a tabernacle, in a temple, in a tabernacle, a holy place. And so then between the end of that and 37 and 40, which is where it starts, we're going to start seeing it reveal this temple. 38 and 39 are kind of an interlude where one of the means that God is going to use to get the attention of Israel is being described. So if you want to think of 36 as he's talking about he's going to regenerate Israel, bring them to know him and bring them back into the land, and 37 again, it restates that with the Valley of the Bones and so on. 38 and 39 are kind of a zoom in at that time of the end, because it mentions it talks about the latter days in verse 8, after many days you will be visited in the latter years, and we'll see that phrase used again. So what he's saying in 38 and 39 now is he's kind of zooming in, he's saying, okay, now I've told you the scheme about what I'm going to be doing with Israel. Now in 38 and 39 I'm going to give you a glimpse of a historical thing that's going to happen, where enemies are going to come against Israel in kind of an overwhelming way. And I'm going to step in and clean house. I'm going to step in such a big way, not because of what Israel, who they are and what I owe them, but because of my promises and because of my holy name, which has been blasphemed by the fact that he can't fulfill his promises to Israel because they're in disobedience, right? So all the stuff we see on the news about Jerusalem and the promised land and the fighting over how big Israel should be and all that, ultimately that is a black eye to God, as he says in this passage, because part of the reason that his name is maligned is because, well, Israel is supposed to be, their God is supposed to be the God of Israel, you know, the God we're studying here, and our Savior too. But he can't bless them in the way he stated, and so people think, well, a lot of what it says about Israel is irrelevant. I mean, even large parts of the church think Israel is irrelevant, right? So in 38 and 39, he's going to zoom in and say, okay, here's a historical situation where a bunch of different nations are going to come against Israel, and it's going to be in the latter, you know, after many days, in the latter years. And it talks about the Jews will be in the land in verse 8, of those brought back from the sword and gathered from many people. So the idea there is this, again, this issue of Israel will be gathered. This will be a time after Israel has been scattered all over the place, and a large number, maybe it doesn't say how many, but a large number of Jews will be gathered back into the land. But notice at the time that they're gathered, like we saw in the previous chapter, they don't know God. Right? And so that's just like the bones, right? The bones are assembled, the flesh is on there, but there's no spirit. So, and so I was making the argument before that historically, this, I believe the period we're in, and many other people believe the period we're in, is we're in that period where God is starting to gather the bones and to put flesh, you know, move toward putting flesh on the bones to have Israel back in the land, but not knowing him. And so then the kind of the climax of this age, if you really think about it that way, is what's God going to do to bring Israel to know Jesus and to accept him as the Messiah? So that statement that Jesus says at the end of Matthew 23, you won't see me again until you say, mm-hmm. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So among all the other things that God is doing in this period of time, one of the things he's doing is he's working his way toward regenerating Israel. And the way that that's going to be done involves gathering them, then some tough things happen.
Purges are pretty good.
Yeah, there's a purging that occurs. Yeah, there's passages that talk about, you know, he'll bring the sheep under his rod and the unbelieving ones will be cut off, and only a third will survive that process. So between So between the negative things that happened to Israel, which caused them, of course, to seek out and cry out to God,
mm-hmm.
you know, as well as his intervention, like in this chapter, the emphasis is on his intervention, that this particular historical event is one of such magnitude. So the way these, when you look at how these enemies are defeated, it's not because Israel goes out and kills them, it's because of things that God does,
mm-hmm.
Including them becoming confused and turning on one another. So the whole thing is couched in a way where it's God is essentially saying, this is a situation where Israel would have been doomed if I didn't step in. But I'm going to step in a way that's very dramatic so that the nations will see this is really weird and question how could this happen. And at the same time, my people Israel will see that I've moved on their behalf. So any questions or thoughts about that overall context? And so as we saw in the first part of the first seven verses of Ezekiel, it names all these different people and places. And mostly what we discussed was this idea that most of the names of geographical locations in the Bible come about from the names of people. That if you go back to the Table of Nations in Genesis 10 and work your way down, you'll find Agog and you'll find Magog, you know, and there are people and then their descendants that come from them end up being the ones that are connected to those names, like Cush and Put, Tubal, Gomer. Tarshish, these are all people that you'll find their names in the Bible. If you looked at a biblical genealogy, have you ever seen these charts where people try to do a tree mm-hmm. of the whole Bible genealogy? And so way up in there, you'll see these names of these same names, and they're related to people, but in the context of what's given to Ezekiel, it's this idea that at the time of Ezekiel, these names are describing the people who were offspring from those original peoples. So, you know, if you look at Gog, for example, Magog's a good one to look at to start with, but in Magog, where Gog of the land of Magog, if we looked back, we could find that the grandson of Noah is called Magog in Genesis 10:2 and 1 Chronicles 1:5, and he is the son of Japheth, who is the son of Noah. So Noah comes Japheth, is one of his sons, and then out of that comes this grandson.
What is the original language mean for that name?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have that in my notes. I'd have to look at it. But this is kind of the same situation you'll see for these names. So when you gather up all these names and look at different sources, they end up being lands that are in Arabia, Persia, Northern Africa, Russia potentially, depending on different arguments about the meaning of the name Rosh or whether it means chief. You know, remember we talked about Rosh means head or chief. So in modern day terms, you would see, you know, Afghanistan, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, areas that are in Turkey today, Black Sea areas, Russia. And then as you go further south, you have Libya, Sudan, and some people think Eastern, as far east as Eastern Europe, but I'm not so sure about that. But, and of course, Tarshish is mentioned later on, not in the attacking groups, but as making a comment about what takes place, and that is most people consider that to be southern Spain. So, when you kind of lay it on a map, it ends up being a group of people that are, you know, in an arc above Israel, and then a few more that are down around the south part.
Do they border? They actually border it?
They're pretty close in some cases. You know, they would be, you know, like whether, for example, Syria today, borders Israel, but
Iran doesn't, though.
No, Iran doesn't, but Iraq does. You know, not all of these border Israel, but immediately, but they're not too far away.
Right.
And so, one of the things, of course, that's interesting about this too is because when prior to Israel being back in the Middle East, right, after the Roman dispersion and the Jews being moved all over, and there was a long period of time there was no Israel, right? So here you've got this prophecy about these geographic areas, people that occupy geographic areas that are around Israel, and for a long time there were no Jews in the middle part, or very few, mm-hmm. right? And so this is an example where here's this prophecy that sat in the Bible and sat in the Bible for a long time. And if you're one who doesn't believe it's been fulfilled, which I'm in that camp, then there were long periods of history where it looked particularly unlikely, a lot more unlikely than it looks today, right? So that's just an interesting thing to notice, that, you know, God can state things in the scripture that don't look, at points in history, they don't look like they're going to happen to the natural eye. But, you know, you have to keep coming back. And, you know, if there's one thing that God gets through over and over about the scriptures is that when he says things, you can take it to the bank, you know. No matter how unlikely it seems, when he says it's going to come down a certain way at some point, you know, it will, because obviously he can see the future, and he not only does he see it, but he's involved in bringing it to pass as well. Mm-hmm. So any comments or questions about the whole business of the people groups that we kind of looked at earlier, or anything else in the very first part of Ezekiel that you remember? So a key verse is verse 8. After many days you will be visited, in the latter years you will come into the land of those. He's talking about this guy. He's talking to the Gog and these people. In the latter years you will come into the land of those brought back from the sword, gathered from many people on the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They were brought out of the nations, and now all of them dwell safely. Right? So there's that setting again where for a long time people were scattered all over, and it says here they were brought back from the sword, and the idea being there that they were sent out of the land by the sword and persecuted all over the place, and from that time of persecution they were gathered on the mountains of Israel, and during the time they were out of the land was desolate. It wasn't thriving. It wasn't a thriving Jewish homeland. But they were brought out of the nations, and now all of them dwelled safely. And of course, that's the phrase we spent quite a bit of time talking about. You guys were in California, I think, at the time. But, you know, this apparently takes place at a time when they're in a peaceful setting. Because if you look at verse 11, he's talking again to Gog about when he's going to make his evil plan, and he says to Gog, "You will say, I will go up against a land of unwalled villages. I will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates." So that's one of the key things that he's saying in this passage. He doesn't just say that, well, you know, they think they're safe but they're not. I mean, he's describing It's a land of unwalled villages, a peaceful people who dwell safely without walls, having neither borders nor gates. So they don't think that they're living at a time where they don't think they're in danger. And, you know, it seems to go to quite a bit of extent to make that point. You know? He says, a land of unwalled villages, peaceful people, dwelling safely, dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates. So, you know, in verse 11, he's like, you know, really underscoring. And this is one of the verses that, along with some of the other verses, obviously, that make this a challenging passage to try to locate in history.
Mm-hmm. But the one thing I've heard people talk about, why they think it's really something, is that, I mean, Israel's back, and they brought their language, and that never left, and they've been scattered for, like, 20 centuries. And then all of a sudden they're back, and he says that's a miracle in itself that they still have a common language.
Right.
Most of them, once they've been gone that long, they'll never come back.
Mm-hmm.
They're just absorbed into the rest of the world.
Right. And so one of the things that causes the difference between other groups of people and the Jews, you know, there's at least two things that come to mind. One is, of course, God is preserving the nation, which mm-hmm. he's not necessarily doing in the same way for other nations, because he doesn't have the same promises ledgered against those nations. Like, he's made promises that we saw in Jeremiah, where he says that so long as there's a sun and the moon, the nation will always exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he hasn't said that about a lot of mm-hmm. other nations, so. So obviously he's got, because of what he said, he has a vested interest in bringing that to pass. And then the second thing is persecution. Whereas other groups that have assimilated, the Jews have not been able to assimilate, even at times when they've wanted to, right? So, like, I think one of the things that if you read about World War II, prior to World War II, you know, there were Jews who that were not in favor of Zionism, the move to recreate a Jewish state, because they were sick and tired of being treated as a single people mm-hmm. and singled out.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had a history of persecution and being singled out, they wanted to assimilate. They wanted to be, you know, why can't we just be Jews in wherever we live? Why do we have to be separate in all this? And there are passages where God emphasizes their uniqueness, where he says such a thing will never be, that you will be like other nations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's essentially saying, I'm not going to let you lose your identity as the chosen nation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in the church might think it's done for, it doesn't apply, they might be confused about it, but I'm not going to let you crawl into the woodwork and just be out there. And so not only am I going to preserve you, but I'm going to bring things along that cause you to need to do these
mm-hmm.
things.
The one thing, I forget the word they use all the time right now, but the hatred of Jews, I think God allows that to keep them pushed. The more hatred comes, they're going to want to go back. Get out of Dodge here and go back to, because the hatred just seems like it's increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to go back to where they originated from, where they're basically, instead of the little groups that they have within the nations that they kind of congregate with each other around the synagogue,
right.
Now they'll go back to, well, we're hated so bad here, it's just getting so bad, we're going to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and I think that you know, that played a big part in the decision by Jewish leaders that were behind the Zionist movement, and by others who supported the notion as well that weren't Jews, that they needed to have their own homeland.
Mm-hmm.
because they after World War II, there came the conclusion that we'll never be safe in any other country. We can only ensure our safety if we have the right to fight for ourselves and we control the government that we're in. Mm-hmm. And so that's what led to the search for a Jewish homeland where, you know, South America, different places were suggested, places in Africa, whatever, but, you know, lo and behold, ended up back where they are. So so that whole thing, when we go to, when you look at Revelation 12, where it talks about the woman who's standing on the, clothing the sun, standing on the moon, and she's struggling to bring forth a man-child, right? And when you study it all out, you see that there's this whole historic thing it's giving about Satan trying to intervene and cut off one of God's purposes. One of his purposes, of course, bringing the Messiah forth, which is a huge purpose. But beyond that, after the man-child is born and he's caught up to God and his throne, there's still persecution against the woman who brought forth the man-child. And of course, there's some interpreters who say, well, that woman is the church. So they got it kind of backwards. They think the church brought forth Jesus, but actually, you know, it's this line of descent through the Jews that brought forth Jesus, and then Jesus said, I will build my church, and the church is after Jesus. But at any rate, if that woman has a Jewish component to her, which I think you can make a really clear case from the symbols that she does, then the question arises, well, why is she being persecuted after the Messiah has already been born and been crucified? And if the booster rocket is Israel and the rocket has been fired, which is the Messiah, and he's completed his work on the cross, who cares about the booster rocket? Just let it fall into the sea, right? It doesn't serve any purpose anymore. But in Revelation 12, the booster rocket is in for some heavy heat.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that? Well, because it's not just a booster rocket. It has some more function in God's purpose, and that function relates to the stuff we're looking at now about his promises that are still going to be fulfilled. So this whole issue of persecution comes into the fore again, because even though God allows it and uses it, and it's part of the prophecies he gave in Deuteronomy, the curses, this is what's going to happen to you if you disobey. When we go to Revelation 12, we find out that the real undercurrent, the mastermind behind anti-Semitism, is the dark angel, is Satan. So the Holocaust was a mechanism of Satan, but God uses it in this whole thing, which is the hard thing to deal with. And so here again, there's a situation where in verse 11, somehow Israel has gotten to this place where it appears to be a time of safety. And the fact that it is a time of safety looks like it's a key part of what
mm-hmm.
God takes advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or they believe they're safe.
Yeah, but it says they're dwelling without walls.
Right.
Having neither bars nor gates. So they believe it to the extent that they don't have the defensive things
mm-hmm.
you would have if you didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a belief that they've put into action. Practical
mm-hmm.
action. Obviously, they aren't really safe because this guy's going to attack them.
Right.
Right? I mean, if they were absolutely safe, this, you know, he wouldn't be able to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a balance here. I mean, obviously, they think they're safe, but also it's not just that they have a perception. They've actually put that perception into practice as far as how they're living. So it's like, so this is one of the verses that makes it hard to figure out exactly where this fits in, and it's one of the verses that I would use to say that some things have got to change from this point
mm-hmm.
before this were to happen. Because I don't follow the news every day, but I just don't think verse 11 fits our time. And so this again is one of those verses when you read it, you go, how does that work? And I think the how does that work part of the answer to the how does that work is that it doesn't work right now. And our problem is that we're so used to where we're at now that we can't envision how radically things could change in a quick way to where things could be a lot different. Certain people come into power, certain agreements happen.
Right.
Well, yeah, I was thinking that Antichrist making that peace treaty for
yeah.
bringing out.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
And the start of this. I mean,
right.
That's, where else in the Bible does it talk about, you know, peace treaty with Israel?
Well, yeah, and there isn't, it doesn't talk about explicitly a peace treaty made with Israel. It talks about, if you read it in context, it just talks about, let me go there, because in Daniel 9, it does talk about the fact that this individual will destroy many through peace. But if you look at the key passage where a lot of this is poured into, it's in Daniel 9. But I'll read 26 and 27. So it's talking about a period of time where Jerusalem's going to be rebuilt and the wall in troublesome times. And then after 62 weeks, it says, from some particular starting date, in verse 26, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. And then verse 27 is the one that is, this is a verse that people pour a lot into, and we have to be careful how much we pour into it, because what it says is, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. So it's a difficult to translate verse 27 all the way through. There's quite a variety in how it's translated, but the first part, he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. That is the peace agreement you'll hear people talk about. But it doesn't say peace there.
No.
All it says is that presumably the people of the prince who is to come that destroy the city and the sanctuary, this is the prince, is the idea. Now there's, and we can talk about this too, but so this is, I believe this is the prince. He's going to confirm a covenant. The prince of the people who destroy the city and sanctuary. We're not talking about Messiah. I'm talking about the one who comes out of Rome, the Antichrist. He confirms his covenant with many in Israel for a 7-year period. And in the middle of that 7-year period, he brings an end to sacrifice and offering. So there's nothing in here that says there's peace, although it could be part of this. You know, usually when there's
if you
a covenant,
take the context of then it becomes, you know, desolation and makes desolate, complete destruction.
Peace comes to an end when the middle of the week occurs, is what you're saying.
Well, what I'm just saying is that the end of this verse talks about the bad things.
Mm-hmm.
So there had to be good things before that.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. You can infer from that verse that things were not destruction and desolation.
Right.
Or they believed there were some good things. Yeah.
Right. So the covenant appears to be a positive thing from Israel's perspective that gets violated in the middle of the week. Right.
Right?
Because the implication is to, especially today, I mean, we have certain things that, we have some advantages here, just because we're further along in history, and one of them is, interesting that in the middle of the week, the big thing that he brings to an end is sacrifice and offering,
right.
which seems...
a worship of God, which, you know, God's accepting their way of sacrifice and...
Well, just the fact that they would have motive to want to do sacrifice and offering.
Right. Right.
Because at the time of Jesus, they didn't have any need to make a covenant to do sacrifice and offering.
So you're saying this is a covenant that's doing that. I thought it was a covenant, and they just happened to be parallel doing their temple worship, so that they were in God's good graces. And this is a side thing that's come in.
Well, the structure of the sentence,
not religiously.
The structure of the sentence implies there's a connection. It, like in mine, the way it's translated, then he shall confirm a covenant, da 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 da, but in the middle of the week,
mm-hmm.
something unexpected happens that isn't in line with that covenant. And it's bringing an end to sacrifice and offerings. So the implication.
So you're saying he's made a covenant to allow that. It's not just that he's permitting it.
I'm saying that the covenant, the implication is that the covenant concerns, in part, the ability for them to do sacrifice and offering
permission.
In the temple.
He's still giving permission, but it's not necessarily that they're, that's only part of it, it seems like.
Yeah, it could be more.
Yeah.
But I'm saying here that this thing is talking about a covenant. And the only thing it tells us about the... This is an agreement, a covenant, a berit. It doesn't tell us anything about what's in that covenant, except that
it obviously allows for sacrifice.
In the middle of the week, there's an interruption because he makes a covenant for a week. So there's some sort of a promise for 7 years, or you know, seven periods. And in the middle of that time, something major happens related to sacrifice and offering, which kind of implies there's an interruption in what was supposed to last 7 years. It doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
He jumps in the middle and says, no.
He breaks it.
And of course, when we put together all the rest of the stuff we see all over the Bible about this time period, the thing that happens in the middle is when he goes and takes his seat in the Holy of Holies, the abomination of desolation occurs right in the middle of the last seven period. And so from other... And that's the sign that Jesus says, when you in Judea see that a flee to the wilderness, and in Revelation 12 it tells us how long they have to flee to the wilderness for times, and half a time, 1260 days, it's 3.5 years
mm-hmm.
of 360 day years. So when you take the piece here and you take a piece there and you lay them all down on the table, you can make the case that this agreement during this last 7 years gets goofed up right in the middle of that time, which would coincide to the time when various other things in Revelation occur and in Thessalonians.
I might be wrong, but what gets me is that the covenant, and then you know, cutting it off in the middle way. Even if you look at it now, Israel is pretty well armed.
Mm-hmm.
They could be so armed at that point where he needs them to actually believe something to put everything away and actually become basically a roll over a soft underbelly that he can take over. I don't know, that's just something, I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah.
That covenant's for a reason. So he's got a plan to cut it off middle way, but there's something there that he wants Israel to be defenseless for whatever reason.
Well, yeah, and so the question too is, you know, if we look at the words of Jesus in Matthew 24, and if we think the abomination of desolation, where he says this is the sign that you're supposed to flee, if that's the middle of the week. Which I think you can make a really good case it's in the middle of the week, then that's going to be the time of great tribulation for
mm-hmm.
Israel, that
mm-hmm.
last 3.5. And so as soon as that occurs, they're in big, big trouble from that point forward. And short of Jesus stepping in,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
they'd be in big trouble. So I think prior to that point, something's happened where they have, you know, this covenant is a key part, but whether they may have had other things occur prior to that where they think it's peaceful way ahead of this period of time.
Yeah.
But my feeling is, based on the emphasis of the covenant part, that this covenant is what gives Israel the right to restore their sacrificial system, the Orthodox Judaism, not
right.
Christianity, Orthodox Judaism will be able to resume their sacrificial system. And the reason it gets cut off in the middle is he's going to take his spot in the Holy of Holies instead of it being sacrifices to Yahweh, right?
So you're saying that the Tribulation Temple is actually probably built at the beginning of that covenant, and that his whole purpose is to really be, you build this house for me, so that when it's done and goes along for a while, then I can come and sit in it.
Well, I don't know what's in his mind about what he thinks about the purposes, but if in Revelation 11, you have that temple mentioned and it gets measured.
Right.
And if you look at, there's there's these witnesses who testify to God and call down various plagues, and then they get killed by the beast who rises from the abyss. And again, you can make a real good case that he rises at the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So what that also argues, if you look at their ministry, is that the first half of the week, they're ministering while that temple is standing. It's standing no later than the beginning of that last week. How much earlier than that that it was built, it doesn't
That's what I'm asking, because it's thinking, so you have this covenant, and part of that covenant was to build that temple, but you're not saying that it is tied. Like, I've never thought it was, but the way you said it, I was like, oh, now it's tied, really? Okay, so it starts with him, and he is the one that really has the emphasis and the motivation to build it for him to sit in it, that kind of thing. So that's not necessarily true. Then you can't.
It doesn't.
You can't say that wasn't there before he showed up.
You can't say when the temple's going to be rebuilt, other than by the time of Revelation 11, and by this time, if they're offering sacrifices, it's going to be in a temple.
Okay,
right?
So it doesn't just start to be built, and sacrifice and offering start right on that treaty time, or covenant time.
I'm implying that the sacrifices do start, and I'm implying that the covenant is part of what gives them permission to do these sacrifices and offerings.
And they weren't doing it. See, that's what I was thinking, is it's been built already, it's already been going on, he just comes in and keeps it going, allows it to keep going, and then comes in. That was my take before it started. So, I guess that's my question then. What makes you think then it, the sacrifice and all that just starts with this covenant and isn't going on? If the temple's already built, why wouldn't it be going on? I guess.
Okay. Well, I think the temple has to be built first.
Right.
And then they have to start their,
right,
resume the sacrifice. And that potentially it is such a politically charged thing that, building the building is one thing, and that they probably got a lot of permission and stuff just to do that. But then to actually, the reason I think that it's related is how this is worded.
Okay.
When I look at this verse 27, it says he's going to confirm a covenant.
Mm-hmm.
But, see, that's all I need to say. He's going to confirm a covenant, but, it's actually the word and, because in Hebrew it doesn't distinguish, it's a wa consecutive, they call it. But the people who translate it look at the overall structure of the whole phrase, and they're saying that it's adversative. It's not an and, it's a but. So if I say, I was going to go water skiing today, but okay, something went wrong. It got in the way of my water skiing. The boat wouldn't start, it snowed, something happened, I'm not going water skiing. And so this is, there's a covenant, but there's an end brought to sacrifice and offering. And so the implication is that even though there was a covenant which allowed for this, but no, he's interfering, right? And the sacrifice and offering, so the other thing that I'm connecting with this again, which isn't right in this passage, is that the Antichrist comes and takes his seat in the Holy of Holies, and him doing that is going to interfere with the normal. You know, the Jews would never allow that,
right?
Mm-hmm. And so that's going to interfere with
that's
part of the but that's involved here, right? So so when we look at a passage like this, we can infer a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't say definitely. Even what I'm saying is an inference, right? I'm saying I think this covenant has to do with the sacrifice and offering, the permission to do it, to resume it.
So could they,
but I can't prove that.
So you could even say that they built the temple and then it could sit for a long time, even not even sacrifices or anything going on,
right?
Because of, because I keep thinking, well, you built it, now you're going to use it right away, and that's an assumption. Yeah, okay.
Right, and you see in Revelation 11 it talks about that the outer court is given to the Gentiles to trod. So there's this implication that it's not just the Jews that are focused on this temple, that it has a religious focus that's broader than just the Orthodox Jews.
Mm-hmm.
We can only kind of speculate on these little fragments.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I wanted to say here is that this covenant doesn't really say a covenant of peace.
Mm-hmm.
Although for them to enter a formal agreement, it seems like they're going to be getting something for that, which would imply that, you know, it's not persecution that they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's something they really agreed on.
Yeah, something they really agreed on. It's being highlighted here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely, extremely important biblically, because it's the thing that triggers the last seven.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at measurements in the scriptures, it talks about the 62 weeks, 62 and 62 and 7, that gets you up to 69. There's things given. You get to 69 and it says after the 69, Messiah is cut off.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that the crucifixion of Jesus, if that's what it's talking about, which I think it is,
mm-hmm.
then Jesus is crucified after the 69th week,
right.
But the last week doesn't start until later. So that's part of the arguments I'd make to say there's a gap, is that it goes through 62 and it starts, or 2 and 7, 69, and then it starts the last one. And in between there's stuff it talks about happening. It says that the Messiah is cut off, people of the princes to come overthrow the city and the sanctuary, right? And that all occurs before this last seven. So that's why I'm saying, you know, there's a gap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The last week is cut off from the 69. And in between there's something that happened that's not revealed in the Old Testament, the mystery of the church. So this covenant, you know, we can say, okay, they're making an agreement. They're able to do sacrifice and offering. They're not going to do that if they're trying to fight off enemies all the time. There's some peace involved with this, for
mm-hmm.
sure. But it doesn't say peace. There are some other passages that imply that he, in Daniel, that he destroys through peaceful means, or through peace or apparent peace. He gains trust. And then there's that passage in Revelation 6 where the first rider on the white horse has a bow but no arrows. Yeah, and that one, you know, you got to, how much weight you want to put in that, because lots of places it talks about people having a bow and arrows. Or it talks about, like here it's going to say to God, I'm going to knock the bow and your arrows out of your hand. But here's this rider on the white horse that goes out in the first seal that's open in Revelation 6. He has a bow. And, you know, how much emphasis can you put in the fact that there's not arrows mentioned? I don't know. I wouldn't put a whole lot of weight on that. I mean, mm-hmm. it might be an inference that he's strong, but he's going to make his progress through peaceful means initially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always took it as a threat. But
I think that's the overall picture, is he's a man of war. I mean, a bow is an instrument of war.
I was thinking it'd be on the same grid as wielding a sword,
mm-hmm.
but not using to kill somebody, but you're still... It's like flexing what we're doing in Korea now. We're flexing our muscle.
Right.
To say, hey, you know, and everybody's flexing their muscle.
Right.
They're throwing the sword around, but nothing's
right.
happening, really.
Right. So the trick on all of this stuff is that you want to notice the details and certain things that are definitely set up to line up. You know, like the middle of the week. What happens to the two witnesses? How does it happen? Who kills them? When does it happen? What are the time periods it gives you there? How does that hook up with this last week? All that stuff you can put together. But other things like, well, is this a peace covenant? It doesn't say peace. There's implications, maybe, that there's a peaceful aspect to it. And other things like, okay, the guy rides out with a bow in Revelation 6, but it doesn't mention arrows. Well, maybe that's significant, maybe it's not. So you know, you...
Or you take it... I guess, you know, when you compare it to other verses that say bow and arrows, you know, you go, well, how come they said arrows there, but they didn't say
right.
arrows here? So you got to, you know, to do something different.
Maybe. Uh-huh. See, there's the problem. That's the problem with language, right? Human language. God's not writing a technical manual, right? He's writing letters with average day Joes. I mean, they're inspired of the Spirit, but they're still, the way they say things, and I know God has them include the right words and all that, but my point is that there are places where the words, each little word carries a freight load, and there's other places where if you put a freight load on those words, you're in danger of abusing the passage, because it doesn't necessarily, you can't put a freight car on each word. And that's part of rightly dividing the scriptures, is this whole idea of over time knowing where the ice is thin and where it's thick. Where it's thick, you can put a lot of weight on it, it's not going to bust. Where it's thin, you can't put a lot of weight on it, because your inference that it admits the word the, is that significant or not? In some situations it is, in others it's not. And you have to look at the overall context and gather all the evidence. It's like being a detective. You know, you can go into the same room. You can go into different rooms with the same sort of evidence. And in some cases, you know, a letter opener laying on a table is absolutely insignificant. And in other cases, it's critical, right? Mm-hmm. And whether it's critical or whether it's insignificant are based on all the rest of the mystery you're trying to solve. Right, other things that you've got, other things you know about who was in the room, or you know what they do with letters there or whatever, you know. And so this is the same sort of thing, and it can be frustrating, right? Because the tendency is to want to pour significance into every word equally, and I don't think that'll get you there. And the other approach, which is there's places where it definitely is saying things in a different way and you kind of ignore them. That's not getting there either. That's where you have to kind of look at a lot of the related passages and try to build, you know, a lot of stuff straightforward and it's just said that way. In other places, you have to kind of put things together. So like this passage we're looking at right now, I'm giving you my view of it, the dispensational view, and this is the view you'll find Pastor Chris teaching at Commando Chapel. This is the view that you'll find Mike Evers teaching over at Calvary Chapel. But it's not the view of all the other teachers in all these other movements or churches even. Like at Commando Chapel, there are some people that would teach this a lot differently. They're going to tell you the covenant. The person that's confirming the covenant is Jesus. Yeah, it's called the New Covenant. Yeah, in the upper room. That's the covenant. And in the middle of the week, after roughly 3 years of ministry, he went to the cross and he brought an end to the sacrifice and offering. That's the book of Hebrews. Right?
I got a question. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, of course, it's the rider on the white horse, the bow. And then you go on down farther, and you have Christ coming back on a white horse, and they go into great detail about what he looks like, and it's almost like strike fear into something because he's coming back for war, I mean, into war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thought kind of in the same thing where it just strike fear into something, you know, as a threat. That's why I kind of come. I was trying to make a parallel
mm-hmm.
with the one thing, just because they go into such detail about what he looks like,
right.
And then they're going into detail of what this guy looks like. But he's human,
right.
So he's about all he's got is a bow. It's not like what Christ has. So that's where I kind of come from. That's where
right.
I went.
Right, and he rides for it to overcome or to
mm-hmm.
conquer, Nikeo, and so he's, and elsewhere in Scripture it makes a big deal about Jesus is the true overcomer,
mm-hmm.
and that's why we're overcomers, because we're in Christ. He has overcome the world. So Christ is the true overcomer, this rider is the false overcomer,
mm-hmm.
and so that's this whole business again about the pseudo-Christ or antichrist. Anti doesn't always mean against, sometimes it means false or like. Imitation, and so there's this issue that the rider that comes out on the white horse, and then another rider later comes out on the
mm-hmm.
white horse, and the first one is trying to look like
mm-hmm.
the last one,
mm-hmm.
and the scripture is telling us he's going to convince some people that he
mm-hmm.
is the last one.
Yeah, but I also see one's weaker than the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's why. But still, I think it's the same impression.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all
right. So this time of, so part of what we struggle with this Ezekiel passage that we're looking at with Gog and Magog is, you know, where do we put it?
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the things we can look at that give us keys about where we can't put it are these things about dwelling safely.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's going to be this situation where they end up taking all the weapons after this all goes down and using the weapons for fuel for, it says, a period of 7 years.
That's interesting.
And of course, so the clues in the passage help to tell us where we can or can't put this. And of course, some people would say, like we talked about a little bit, is, you can't even put this in the future, Tony, because they're riding on horses. They're using javelins and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
When was the war last fought like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that whole issue of how it's described, some people would say, that alone tells you it can't be in the future. And of course, there's answers to that, like we talked about last time, one being that there's nothing that says that technology will continue at the level it's at now, that we won't go through a time of immense disruption where we lose the ability to do some of the technologies we have now.
Beyond your sword.
Well, they already talked about being able to just wipe out computers now with an explosion above the earth. It, you know, they, it might be true, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But you think about what would happen if something did happen, and would they, you know, pulse or whatever they call it,
mm-hmm.
would just wipe out computers, tanks would stop, everything would just be stopped. What else you got? Go back to square one with the old war.
Yeah, so there's that whole possibility, which is a sobering thing. And then the other possibility is that it's couched in terms that Ezekiel would understand, using things that Ezekiel understands are weapons of war. You know, and the other aspect to think about is, this is, I don't think, symbolic per se, but in the passage in Revelation is, but of course, Revelation 19, Jesus is going to ride with the armies of heaven on horses,
mm-hmm.
it says. There, you know, we know those are symbols, and the scripture is very clear to make the case that Revelation is described using signs and symbols. You know, so it's full of signs and symbols. They have a literal meaning that Jesus is a victor of an army that's coming back. Do I expect to see Jesus, you know, flying over the Milky Way on a horse? I don't know. I don't think so, but, you know, maybe a cherub that is reminiscent of a horse. I don't know. but so there, those are kind of the things to look at. And I used to lean pretty heavily toward the view that it's just the way God is referring this to Ezekiel, because he, you know, I can't describe it using what might actually be used at that time. But over time, I've come more and more to favor the view that this is really what it's going to be, and that people are not going to have modern weapons in this setting. But I can't, you know, I don't know. That's a scary, to me, that's a lot scarier situation to think about.
Because the way they describe it, though, they burn it. And so it's almost like they get rid of it by burning it. You can't get rid of metal.
Yeah, and it talks about they won't need to cut down trees for fuel. And it's clearly saying that the implements they're burning is fuel. Well, who's burning trees for fuel in Israel today, for one? And how does, you know, you can't turn around and say, well, they're fusion reactors. They're heating their homes with fusion reactors that they captured from the high-tech weaponry. I mean, that's going pretty, that's like Hal Lindsey used to talk about Revelation 9, which is, seems pretty clear, talking about demonic things, and he tried to make it helicopter gunships. You know, it's like, well, you know, you've got to be careful how far you can go with this stuff. So, you know, if you take it at face, here's the thing, it's like, God uses hyperbole, he uses symbolism, but I don't want to be there at the judgment seat of Christ and have goofed up stuff because I just didn't take it literally enough, right? I'd rather be on the side of occasionally making error where I'm like, I'm missing some symbolism maybe, you know? But because there's this, you know, it's like, well, what does it say? You know, you always come back to, well, what does it say? Well, it says, you know, burning weapons.
Yeah, that always kind of made me scratch my head.
So the problems we have is we have ancient weaponry. We've got a time of peace where they believe they're at peace and enough to where they've actually changed how they're living.
Mm-hmm.
We have this situation that after it occurs, there's a period of 7 years that they're, you know, gathering these weapons and burning these weapons. And after it occurs, there's a period of 7 months where they're out flagging dead bodies and ceremonially taking care of them in a way where you don't get ceremonially unclean, right? There's the whole Jewish aspect if you don't touch a dead body, right? So, you got that 7 months, you got these 7 years, you got this peace situation, and it's in the latter days, at the time of the end. It talks about, it makes a couple statements in the next chapter too about it's tied in with the regeneration of Israel and bringing them to faith, which appears to be prior to the second coming of Christ, near the end. But, you know, if in the middle of the last seven they have to flee and they're persecuted like all get out, the time of Jacob's trouble, the great tribulation, they're not going to be sitting in Israel collecting wood and burning weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to be, you know, marking bodies and carefully disposing of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where do you put it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the biggest thing that different interpreters, you know, wrestle with. Of course, there's a bunch of interpreters. The way they handle it is they say, well, this has already occurred, so we don't have to worry about where to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you ask them, well, where did it occur, they can't really give you anything that's at all convincing without going like taking this in such a general weird way that you can't even tell. Here's this one of these most dramatic things that God describes in the Bible about him intervening and doing this and that and the other, and we can't even tell if it's happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well,
then
Israel will know, then the nations will know, except we as Bible scholars can't even figure out when it happened, and we've got all these, we're sorting through history looking back trying to find it, and you're convinced it's happened already, right? So I just don't see how we can go there. And I think most interpreters say this has not happened. It's either really symbolic or it hasn't, you know, it's still going to happen.
But what I can believe is it can happen quick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just by kind of semi-overnight, I'm not saying it will, but in a matter of just a short time, everything can change.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, if you look at, you know, if you look at part of what's behind this whole thing and other things we've talked about tonight is this simmering problem of the Middle East, right? Jerusalem, Israel, the Jews, the final solution, what Hitler called it. Why do you call it the final solution? Well, it's been a problem for a long time,
mm-hmm.
right? And I don't agree with his term and his idea, but the fact that he would call it a solution gives you an idea of the mindset of, look, what do we do with this big pain?
Mm-hmm.
This big pain, and it's still a big pain, and it's an ongoing pain. And so when Jesus, or when Zechariah says, God says, I'm going to make Jerusalem a cup of reeling, a stone of stumbling to those who are gathered against it, there's this whole idea that somehow the nations are still focused on Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see some of these scenarios that have to do with things involving Israel and Jerusalem, then you come away with this understanding that it appears there's going to be a very large desire to solve this ongoing problem. And so part of what could happen very rapidly is if the right individual or the right groups, the right movements come mm-hmm. along that appear to purport to be able to solve these problems and negotiate a negotiated peace, you could see how people would really jump on board on that in a big way, because wow, that's a solution that we've needed for a long time.
Or not just that, it's that all the other solutions haven't worked, which are always fighting and da 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 da. So why do the same thing over again? You know, do the opposite. You know, the peace deal or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
When I look at the Camp David Accord and all, I mean, people have been trying to get mm-hmm. peace in the Middle East by all different means.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just this ongoing contention. So behind all this, and what Sid's saying too about how quickly things can change, I think those are things we need to keep in mind, that things have changed pretty rapidly at certain times. Because if you look at the Zionist movement, which, you know, it became more well known in the very early 1900s, you know, probably started earlier than that, late 1800s, but by 1918 or so, there were, you know, Herzog and certain people were actively working on pushing for a homeland. Again, around, you know, after World War One, you've got this situation, and then when World War Two, you know, then you have the Balfour Declaration and this other situation that occur where you end up with Israel. You know, historically, that's a blink of an eye,
mm-hmm.
right? You're talking like 50 years,
mm-hmm.
right? 50 years, I mean, that's, we're older than 50. Everyone here is older than 50. So, you know, when you're looking at a biblical time scale, that's pretty darn quickly. And that's just this movement toward getting a thing called Israel in the land with Jews there. You know, when we talk about some of these things that are more specific, closer to the time of the return of Christ, those could happen really quickly. Like, I'm one that believes that Babylon is Babylon in Revelation,
mm-hmm.
and that it's going to be rebuilt in a pretty dramatic and rapid way
mm-hmm.
when the time comes. So, those are things to keep in mind. So when we see these things, we go, well, you know, it reminds me, I always have trouble remembering this passage, but there's a passage in, I think it might be in Judges, I can't remember now, but there's a passage where the prophet says, you know, something like, some little bit of food will sell,
yeah,
food won't be, it won't, there's a time of famine, all this, and he's saying food will be so plentiful and it won't cost hardly anything. And this guy questions him, says, I don't see how that could be. And then the army that's attacking leaves, flees, and attacks themselves and freaks out and leaves because of God. And then there's this huge plunder of all their food and stuff there, and it comes true, and the guy gets trampled when everybody's rushing to go get all this stuff. See, I don't want to be that guy. that says, how could that be,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You think about the prefab buildings that they can put up so fast, mm-hmm. entire walls,
mm-hmm.
that they just are able to slip into position.
Mm-hmm. When you look at some of the engineering that's going on in Abu Dhabi and places like that, some of the most magnificent buildings in the world are being built over mm-hmm. in that area. So, you know, but that's a whole different topic. But so,
can I have the temple being rebuilt?
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, does it have to be? I mean, a third temple. It is totally. It's not the one that Christ enters. It's the third temple. Then, does it have to be built on the Temple Mount, or can it be someplace else? You understand what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it would be. I'm just curious. You know, right now they got that Dome of the Rock sitting on there, and mm-hmm. they're really not allowing anything.
Right.
Could they put it off somewhere in another section just because it's the third temple and we can get it built? Or does it have to be on that temple now?
Yeah, I'm not the person that could really answer that question. I've got a bunch of books by different people with different opinions about exactly where it was on the temple, but mm-hmm. most of the people that are into this big time seem to think that the rabbis just won't go for anything unless it's on the site of where the binding of
mm-hmm.
of Isaac was,
mm-hmm.
which is that rock
mm-hmm.
that the Dome of the Rock has in it. At least many mm-hmm. people believe that. So, I don't know.
I just don't know either.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I do know that wherever it's built, it is in Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
and that. That part of it is called the Holy of Holies. Whether it's considered holy by God or not, I don't know. And how, where that has to sit in relation to temples in the past,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to say. I don't know. That's a good question. So we do, you know, those are good questions because we can get hung up in groupthink, you know,
mm-hmm.
about it's got to be this way, it's got to be that way. And of course, part of the way God pulls things off that we can't see how he's going to do it, is he does it a different way.
Right. Reason I ask some of it, because there's so much garbage out there
mm-hmm.
with prophecy stuff, and I sit there and I'm going, and I scratch my head on some of this, going, I don't really buy into that too much, but
mm-hmm.
I'm curious about it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, our, you know, our safety for that is to major on the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
And then don't go beyond everything else that goes beyond that. You know, it's an interesting speculation.
Right.
But it's speculation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so here it's saying in verse 11, it's a peaceful time. They've been gathered out of the nations. Now, we read this last time, which is kind of why I haven't read it again, but. And so he comes, it says in verse 12, they've acquired livestock and goods. And in verse 13, again, we didn't really have time to talk about it as much, but so I'm going to go ahead and say, stupid computers. Here we go. Okay, so look at 13 through, I'll read 13 and 14. Sheba, Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, and all their young lions will say to you, have you come to take plunder? Have you gathered your army to take booty, to carry away silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods, to take great plunder? Therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, thus says the Lord God, on that day when my people Israel dwell safely, will you not know it? Once again, there's God saying that they dwell safely here, and that this guy will know that they have some guarantee of safety, they think, that allows him to just ride in. Because one of the things that we see when we read the rest of this is, it's not Israel that's defeating Gog. So the implication is that God is stepping in, and Israel's not even really prepared to defend itself, which is an interesting thing to think about, because that again is hot Israel today.
Yeah, I look at it, it says seize spoil. So, but right now, this is Israel today, though I've read in a couple of different, three places, it says it's the third strongest economy in the world right now with the gas, the oil they've got. So, there's a good chance they'd be going after that, because that's something that would keep things moving in other countries, so, I don't know.
And the implication is that Sheba and Dedan, Sheba's southwest of Rehob, and Dedan is in the Persian Gulf. And then the merchants of Tarshish, again, if that's southern Spain, like there's some different ideas about that, but if that's Spain, and then depending on your translation, it will say all their young lions, or it will say young leaders, where it will say, there are some things it says. The literal, it'll say all its villages, all her villages, all the young warriors, all its leaders, all its rulers. Like Sid, I think, says all its rulers, HCSB. The literal word is young lions, is what it says. But what it's doing is they're going back to the closest context and how it's used in other parts of passages. You know, remember in Ezekiel 19. So when you look for other parts of the Bible, how these phrases are used, you want to start like with a bullseye. You start close to where you are, and you see, and then you move further and further afield to see how it's used elsewhere. And the closest references are in Ezekiel 19, and it's describing there, talking about young. It's talking about leaders or rulers, the lions, the lions are. It's talked about, symbolically, it talks about young lions as being rulers or kings. And so that's where some people get all its rulers, like yours talking about. Now there's some people, you'll hear this on prophecy shows, because people want to find the U.S. somewhere.
We're part of the young lions, and they really have to reach for that one.
Right. So they make the idea that, okay, well,
we're from
Tarshish,
Spain.
You know, Tarshish is southern Spain, and of course Isabella and Ferdinand, who did they send?
Columbus.
Yeah.
And so
Columbus,
the New World, the New World over here, Canada and the U.S. are offsprings from Tarshish. So we're Tarshish's young lions, and we're over here, and we complain about it, this invasion, but we don't do anything, right? And that's possible, but it's quite a stretch. Another approach is that, well, did you not know that Tarshish is actually a phrase that has to do with tin mining, which it does. The tin mines were in southern Spain. But tin mines were also
in Cornwall,
southwest England. And there's pretty good records showing that tin trade occurred from there into the Mediterranean way back. So Tarshish isn't southern Spain, it's actually Great Britain. And of course, where did America come from? The United States.
Young lion.
Great Britain. So there's another young lion connection, right? You know, and I don't know, I mean, you know.
Well, some people will say we're soared back into the Europe somehow. Things like that. They really don't know. They're giving another big guess.
Yeah.
But we're not mentioned, so the biggest, I think sometimes the biggest possibility, if you want to put your foot out and step in the puddle, is we're stopped somewhere. We're somewhere where we're not effective. We just don't, or we're minding our own business, whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to put my foot in the puddle, that's what I would say, just my own, but I wouldn't teach it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I would tend to agree with that too, that, you know, the Bible doesn't, you know, the Bible is very Israel-centric
mm-hmm.
in its history. Because, I mean, when it talks about, you know, like the vision of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar mm-hmm. gets, there's a bunch of amazing powers of history that aren't in that statue. China's not in there,
mm-hmm.
right? Russia's not in there, right? So you, the United States isn't in the statue of that vision,
mm-hmm.
right?
Australia.
You know, yeah. So, and the land of pickled onions isn't in there. So one of the things that you learn, you know, that you pay attention to the Bible, when the Bible looks through its telescope on the history of the world, you know, it's focusing on things that impinge Israel mm-hmm. and the people of God. And there's huge things that are very significant in the history of the world that just aren't even, there's not even a whisper about them hardly in Scripture, because that's not the focus. The focus is on what God's doing with this nation and with his believers
mm-hmm.
and the world's persecution of it. But it's pretty clear, like you're talking about, in this situation, I think part of what it's saying in verse 13 is these countries aren't going to defend Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're just saying, oh, Gog, is that what you're up to? You know, so it's almost like in today's parlance, you know, they're at the United Nations and they're filing a complaint.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the extent of it, right? It doesn't say that, but that's the thing that brings to mind is, like, you know, they send an ambassador to Gog and say, you know, we formally, you know, it's like Chamberlain and Hitler to start with. Hitler kept doing this stuff and Chamberlain kept trying to appease him and say, well, we'll let you, you know, don't go any further. You got this far. Now let's talk about this or that or the other. And nothing ever really happened for a while. So this could be the same sort of thing, because you don't see the United States jumping in protecting Israel. Whereas if this sort of magnitude thing happened today with the current administration, I think we would be involved militarily. Although that's not even for certain these mm-hmm. days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a year ago I couldn't have said that. So,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, if you were going to look at what's going on now, right now, our focus is not even Israel, it's North Korea. We've got our eyes off of Israel, per se.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if something happens there, you know, the nuclear thing, which they are flexing their muscles in that direction, both sides, I'm going, you know, that could hurt. And we wouldn't do any of Israel any good. We'd be on the sideline rooting them on, basically. It's about the best we could do, possibly.
Yeah. So all we know is that, you know, when it comes to prophecy, we have to wait for it.
Yep.
And when its time is right, it will come to pass. And it is our job to study it and try to make heads and tails of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think too often what happens is there's passages that contain information that we don't know when it all is going to happen, but it says some things that pretty clearly don't match now.
Mm-hmm.
And people aren't willing to say that. It doesn't match now.
Right.
Because, you mean, you're saying the rapture doesn't happen this year? No, that's not what it, you know, that's not what it means. But people who study prophetic stuff have such a desire to want to see it happen now, that when you try to argue, you know, that in the big stream of things that are happening, certain things aren't right, people don't like that, because, you know, and that's why you have to be really careful about how you handle these things, where when you talk about the rapture, what does it mean for it to be imminent, it doesn't mean it's going to happen right away. It just means there's nothing that has to happen first.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know, you know. But other things like this, when it says, okay, they're dwelling in a time of peace and open walls, and this guy's going to know that they're safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to hang my hat on that this year.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't look good, you know. Could it be in 5 years? Maybe, you know. I don't know. But those are some of the things you look at. Just like people have tried to make the case that certain, you know, when a bunch of animals die somewhere or beach themselves, and they mm-hmm. go to Revelation, oh, well, this is the such and such for the sea creatures, da-da-da. And I'm like, no, we're not there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to guess we're not there. I can say unequivocally we're not there. There are certain things that have to happen before that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And they have not happened. You know, that's not predicting the second coming of Christ or the rapture. But it is saying that there is a sequence that God has given us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, you know, when mm-hmm. when they asked Jesus in Matthew 24, they say, well, what's the sign of your coming in the end of the age? And he goes in this long monologue, and he says, when you see such and such flee, mm-hmm. well, that happens before the sign of the Son of Man.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's given us that thing happens before Jesus comes. And until that thing happens, he can't come in the second coming.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You have to be really careful when you talk about this stuff. He can come in the rapture, but he can't come in the second coming.